And welcome back to our webcast series on application compatibility for Windows 8 and beyond. This episode is on application remediation. My name is Chris Jackson. I'm frequently known as the AppCompat guy. I'm an architect at Microsoft, and I'll be walking you through today as we go through and explore how we actually do the investigation and remediation of failing applications for both Windows and the web as part of a transition to Windows 7 or Windows 8 or Windows 8.1 and beyond. So we're going to start our journey today looking at Windows applications specifically and try to get an understanding of how to go through and understand the root cause of failures, as well as how to apply techniques to go through and remediate those failures. So as we think about going through Windows applications, really in applications in general, what I normally like to really make sure we're starting with and understanding the discipline behind that is the whole debugging process and how to tune your mind to think in terms of how do I break this problem down and become very efficient at resolving this issue. And first and foremost, really comes down to the ability to duplicate the bug that you have. So whatever issue is being reported, whether it was caught during technology testing, whether you had someone on your testing team surfacing that, if it's coming from the factory, for example, a lot of people do when working in large-scale projects, or whether it's coming directly from the end user, whether during pilot, whether during user acceptance testing, or sometimes even during production. We don't always catch everything. Making sure we have a bug that we can replicate over and over again is really critical. And what I next do is make sure I spend some time to go through and describe that bug. And I personally choose to write this out. So I keep a notebook in OneNote. And in the past, I've kept it in Notepad, just because that's virtually guaranteed to be on any computer you come across. But writing it out helps you to really think your way through it as you try to describe it. So spending some time to do that, I have found, has been time very well invested. And the next part is just an assumption one, which is make sure you assume it's probably your application. There's a great tendency to think, this is probably the new Windows has a bug in it, which sometimes actually is true. But most of the time, the bug actually happens to be in the application itself, simply because that's the code that's been tested a little bit less often. So just take some time to think, well, if this were not a failure in Windows, if this were a failure in my app, then what are the possible explanations that they can be? And with all of that in mind, with your description, with your ability to duplicate it, to start thinking about your strategies to divide the problem up and rule out as many things as possible, thinking creatively as you go along. So what you're looking for when you're trying to think of what's happening is, in essence, to build a hypothesis. What could be causing this application to fail in this way? And it's the quality of that hypothesis that really reduces the amount of time you spend working on troubleshooting that particular issue. So if I have a hypothesis that says it is this one very particular thing, and then it turns out to not be that thing, then I've sort of left in the bounds most everything else in the world it could possibly be. Whereas if I can think of a hypothesis that would say it's either in the network or not, then I rule out the entirety of networking if I'm able to go through and prove that. So it's all about looking for a good theory and one that's not as niche, but rather just sort of keeps you within one domain, and then figuring out which tools are going to help me to prove whether or not I'm correct and my hypothesis is correct. And that ends up being particularly important from a time savings point of view, because if I have tools that are very easy to use, I can come at answers much more quickly. In fact, only when I've exhausted my tool set that I want to spend any time doing any heavy debugging. So if I'm going through and doing some heavy debugging, that's when I'm really exhausted the capabilities of my tools. So we'll go through and we look at the Windows applications, and when we look at web applications a little bit later in this webcast, we're going to expose the tools that are most helpful in order to help us avoid having to go through and doing the low-level troubleshooting. Once I'm done and I figured out what the issue is, then spend some time ensuring that you've actually been able to successfully fix that bug. And once you've done that, spending some time to write that down, to learn from that, to share it. I'm a huge advocate of having an internal project portal wherein you can share your findings. Here's how I did the troubleshooting for anyone else who may be learning to do troubleshooting, as well as here's what I did to fix it. And the reason why I find this to be particularly important in the world of AppCompat is because at customer after customer that I've worked with, what I've noticed is the types of issues that come up in AppCompat come in clusters. And so we see over and over again, if I've made this mistake in this one part, in this one app, this one area of the business, we tend to find it again. There's just a lot of commonality. And a lot of that's probably expected. You know, we have folks working together within one environment. They do some sharing. Obviously, they share the really good code as well as the code that may work perfectly fine in one environment but may not be as durable as others, and that sharing helps to identify those patterns earlier. So it's a really very deliberate process, one that applying this discipline, even though it seems like we've sort of added a lot of steps to, you know, go in and troubleshoot it, thinking through each of these individual steps can dramatically shorten the amount of time you go through doing investigations. So this is how we debug. The next question is, how do we fix, right? And in a previous webcast, we looked at the different options for remediating, all the way up to, hey, go in and fix the code, all the way down to, well, we'll have to run this in a virtual environment, something running a compatible operating system still. But in between was this layer of technology, and this is something that the technology team has the ability to do, and that is the concept of a shim. So next, let's explain exactly what that means. What is a shim? And so to explain this, right, we'll do this in the demo, so we'll actually see the shim approach going through and fixing applications. But I wanted to spend just a couple of minutes explaining what's really going on in the context of applying a shim and how that works. So the way that shims work is that they take advantage of the way that Windows itself links code together. So when I think about, hey, I've got a binary file, it's an .exe, and it's going to leverage a lot of DLLs, or dynamic link libraries. And a way that it does that is because we have this layer of indirection. So inside of each executable, we've got some headers, which has a list of directories, and each of those directories has a list of all of the DLL files and the functions within them that it uses. That's called the import table, also sometimes called the import address table. And if I look inside how that table is structured, it's going to have a list of all the DLLs that end up being used. And it's also going to have a list of all of the functions within that DLL. And those functions are initially embedded as an offset. Go this many bytes into this DLL, and you'll find this function. And that's done very much on purpose, because, you know, even though most DLLs have a what we call a preferred start address in memory, which is assuming this memory is free, this is where I'd like to be put. Sometimes somebody else is already there and we have to move you. And so by having this, you know, offset within a DLL, that makes moving you a whole lot easier, because now instead of having to go in and, you know, find all specific references to where you are, I just go into this table and say, well, let's say kernel 32 got moved, so get module handle A is no longer at its preferred start address plus this offset, it's at its new start address plus this many additional bytes of memory, read it out of this table, and that's how I jump there. And you can kind of see where this is going, read it out of this table. All we have to do to put in different behavior and put in a different function is to go in and put a different address in this table pointing to another DLL, in this case, the shim DLL. Now, the concept itself has been around for a while, and I kind of put some source code, not because this is a session talking about C programming at very, very low levels, because this is very much non-trivial C code, but rather this is not a completely new and unique process. This is a bit of sample code that I took directly from a book published by Jeff Richter and Christoph Nassar back in 2008, and Jeff Richter actually had this in his code for, you know, writing for Windows way back in the 1990s, that this is a very common technique, and in fact, it's all the way back to the mainframe era. And we think about it a little bit more simply, right, kind of getting out of the nitty-gritty of what's going on at the memory level. When we are applying a shim, in essence, all we're doing is we are taking a call into Windows, and Windows, from the perspective of the application, is really just a collection of DLLs, and we're replacing it with calls that go into shim DLLs. It's really straightforward. We load the shim DLL, we figure out which APIs we need to hook, and then we go through the import table of the application, so both the XE and NE DLLs, which are also loaded, and figure out, do we need to replace them with calls into our shim DLLs, our replacement calls, which also are shipped and included as part of Windows. So as they're loaded, we go through and we map all the statically linked DLLs into memory, we apply all of our API hooks, and we've then finished our initialization routines. Now, one little caveat to that, if we sort of think about how this redirection would work, and we have a whole bunch of DLLs in our application, we have the application itself plus anything else that it may have loaded, and let's say we're going through and we're applying a shim to change the behavior of create file W. So we think about it conceptually, all we're doing is going through and replacing the address that sits in that import address table with the function of something else that we want, right? And then we say, oh, we're going to apply this particular configuration to go through and modify the implementation of create file in order to change its behavior. In this case, I'm going to substitute a hard-coded path that may be a problem for me so that I now no longer am hard-coding that path. So now, the calls that come from the application, as well as the calls that come from the custom DLLs, will now believe that the implementation of create file is actually coming from this shim, when the shim itself is actually not, you know, doing the real work. It's still calling into create file W, but it's able to go through and modify that behavior. So now we can actually replace a path that may be problematic, whether because of security or for any other reason, with a path that works better. The other thing you'll notice, however, is that not everything got redirected. And this is important because not everything being redirected actually is based upon a set of rules which says that DLLs, or really anything that lives inside of System 32, probably doesn't need to be fixed, right? Because if it's in System 32, it's probably part of Windows. And I think the raw assumption is Windows itself is probably compatible with the latest version of Windows and doesn't need that extra little bit of nudge. In this particular case, though, and this is, you know, looking at an application that's going through and calling earlmon.dll, crypt32.dll, and msxml3.dll, one of them that's potentially likely to be a problem is msxml, because that actually takes in some commands from whoever is calling it that may include a path. So if I need to apply my shim to this one as well, I simply need to add it as an include. So when I go through and add this as an include, and we'll see this in the demo a little bit later, we can redirect that and say this one also needs to go through the DLL because it may need to be corrected as well. And this allows me to add some additional corrections and to configure those corrections. I could, in fact, if I wanted to, go through and include everything, which would redirect everything through my shim DLL. In general, what I like to do is I like to only include those things which I need to, because there is a performance overhead of applying shims. And obviously, for something as frequently called as the file APIs, adding additional unnecessary calls that won't be a match is just a performance loss for no really good reason. But in essence, you know, here's what I need to think about. Everything gets pointed through this DLL. The DLL can modify the behavior. If it wants to do real work, it still needs to call into the kernel32.dll, or in some cases it may return straight away, and we'll see some of the differences between them. Now, as we think about how this gets applied to any given application, shims are always applied when you are loading an application. They're not applied at runtime dynamically as you go. It's just when you start the application during the process of loading in the executable. When we're going through and creating the process, we're going to go through and compare the properties of the exe you're loading with what we've configured for the shim. And inside of Compatibility Administrator, that's what this bit of information does. It will say, hey, if you match up to this particular file, then you need to have the shims I just configured be applied. So in this case, we'll be looking for everything called notepad.exe, which has the file version of 6.0.5505.1 and the product version of the same, right, the bin product version as well as the product version, the company name, the product name, the file version, all of those attributes will be mapped up against when it comes to determining whether or not this is an application that ought to be shimmed or not. And with shims, we have one other thing we're going to introduce, which is the concept of the layer. And this is something that actually probably most people are familiar with. You just may not know that you're familiar with it. A layer has a couple of properties. A layer is a collection of shims, which is designed to target some specific scenarios. And what most people are familiar with is that this is what we show on the compatibility tab of a binary. We show a subset of the available layers on that operating system. So if you've ever gone into the properties of an executable, gone to the compatibility tab, and seen the dropdown, make this application work, and it'll typically have a bunch of, you know, operating system names shown. Well, those operating system names correspond to layers, which is a collection of shims which are designed to help emulate that. The other property of layers is that layers also will apply to all child processes. So that's the other way in which we will often use layers, is not just to put in a number of shims, but also to give us the ability to go through and have that apply not just to the one executable and the one process that gets launched, but if that executable is launching other executables, other processes that need to be fixed as well, we can apply it there. So we have this notion of shims, and we have this notion of layers, right? A collection of shims. All of these are consolidated together into a shim database. And this is what contains the mapping between all of the applications that require fixes and all of the fixes that are available on the operating system. And that's important to keep in mind. So we are creating, you know, shims using the Compatibility Administrator tool. We're not including the code itself. All we're saying is, here's this known fix. It's provided as part of the OS. We're providing the mapping database that says, these are the files that need these fixes applied. And we're just reusing the exact same fixes used by the Windows team itself. In fact, we ship a shim database as part of Windows, and we update it via Windows Update. So if you want to look around, we actually have sysmain.sdb sitting in the Windows directory under the app patch directory beneath it. And then custom SDBs also live in the custom directory beneath that. So that's how we service it. I think a real valid question is, well, how should an organization service their shim database? And it turns out that we actually ship an executable which can be used to deploy custom shim databases as part of Windows also. It's called sdbinst.exe, or shim database installer is what that is short for. And that is what gives us the ability to go through and register any new shim database for the system so we can implement these organization-specific databases addressing code that is not available to the general public, that's internal only, right? Or perhaps is, you know, used by small groups of people, so we haven't discovered it yet. We haven't addressed it from the perspective of Windows itself. It's fairly easy to use that as well, and we'll actually go through and use this approach during the demos to address it. Now, after we deploy them, you know, we may have to do some troubleshooting, or as well as when we're building them itself. So I'll point out also the ability that we have to go through and expose some additional debugging information. So if we go to HKEY Current User, Software, Microsoft, Windows NT, Current Version, App Compat Flags, and create a key called Show Debug Info, and set that key to the value of 9, that will turn on all of the logging that we have for shims. And what that's going to do is it's going to make that logging begin to appear inside of the debugger, if I'm debugging it with, you know, WinDBG or CDB or some other, you know, low-level debugger. And the other thing I like to do is to view that inside of an easier-to-use tool such as SysInternals Debug View, which just shows me the debug stream without getting me into a complete debugging experience. The other thing I can do is go through and apply some logging. So shim logging allows me to just get some additional level of detail. That's not necessarily a problem, so I don't want to have that in the debugging stream, but it's just notifying me of things that happen. I can set an environment variable for that as well, shim debug level and shim file log. The debug level says how far do I want to go. Again, 9 turns everything on, so that's if I'm going to do logging, I normally just do 9, as well as the file log, which lets me put in the name of whatever file I want to put that into, whether that's logfile.txt or shimlog.txt, really whatever I want. That just gives the name of that file, and then that'll show up in the app data directory, and I can go in and find those logs. So that's kind of an introduction. We have, okay, here's the troubleshooting process. Here's the tool that we use to resolve it. Obviously, we've got a tool that we prefer to that, which is let's go in and fix the code, but sometimes we don't have that option. Shims give us the ability to fix applications while we wait for the more permanent long-term code to be resolved. And then obviously if that fails us, we may have to fall back onto some other solution. But with that in mind, let's go through and take a look. Let's do a demo and understand how to go through and do some troubleshooting and remediation of Windows applications.